Our world is magical. Games are magical. Open your eyes and prepare to discover how magic and games intersect.
Merry meet and welcome to Covenstead, a podcast about gaming and magic.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Covenstead podcast. We say this because we know that you are in familiar territories, and our Covenstead has become a place where you say, oh, you know what? I need to get away from all the chaos of this OGL bullshit that has taken over all my social media feeds. I don't know what anyone's playing. I just know what they don't want to play anymore. And I need to go to someplace peaceful with a nice aroma and with birds chirping out the window. And that is us. This is our Covenstead. Welcome. I am Todd, and I am here with my coven mate in crime, Danny. Say hello, Danny.
Hello. How is everybody doing today?
So, yes, as you can tell from the timing of that intro, this is shortly after the OGL fiasco of January 2023. I have no urge to talk about it at the moment, but it has got me thinking that one of these days I think you and I, Danny, have talked about getting into kind of more of like the business side of what we do as being freelancers and that kind of thing. I think that would be something whenever we get around to that episode, reflecting on the OGL shit show, is definitely a worthy topic of bringing up, because I don't know about you, but I was definitely pooping stones for a couple of weeks there, because it was definitely starting to affect some of my clients, which then affects me, and it was like a massive ripple effect. But anyways, that is there, and we are here now, so hello.
No, I feel you. I was pretty like, what the heck is going on myself? So I definitely feel you on that.
Yeah. It's but anyways, what we are gonna do is we're gonna talk about something fun. Today we are gonna continue from our last episode where we were talking about magic in the real world. And how it's practiced, at least from Danny's point of view and everything. But now we want to take from that and we want to start looking into magic when it comes to tabletop gaming. And I guess more specifically within the fantasy genre of tabletop gaming, because that's predominantly where you will see magic. Like we mentioned before, there is a post in our Facebook group. You'll find a link in the show notes where we found these 12 really excellent questions to ask yourself about your magic system. And so Danny and I wanted to go through and discuss them from a gaming standpoint, how we've experienced some of these questions, maybe how we don't, how we think it could enrich magic systems. But then also, too, I'd like to kind of look into how those kind of questions come into our previous discussion about, you know, how Danny practices magic in her life and everything. So cool. Y'all ready and set, Danny?
I am ready.
I have a feeling this is going to be a two-parter. There are 12 questions, and they are damn good questions, I have to say. So let's get started in order. Our first one, how is it learned and executed? How is magic learned and executed? And I think this one seems very basic in the sense of how does magic work in your game?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. In our case, in Novala, I mean, you learn it. I mean, you get, how is it learned? You get taught by other people. Like, it's not like you go and you find a spirit who teaches you this thing or whatever. It's, you learn it from the people around you. You learn it from your family. You learn it from like the elders in the village. You learn it from reading books about things people have done in the past with magic. So it's learned in a really like real world kind of way, rather than having to go on like a quest of some kind or have a special stone or something like that. It's something that's just because it's such a natural part of the world. It's learned. You learned how to work with it from the people around you and the things people have done. So books, people in your village, your family. And because it's so varied, you'll learn different things. You know, there may be things that your family does that are a form of magic that nobody else does. So you learn this thing from your family. So it's really an interesting question because it makes me realize the truly individualistic nature of how magic is learned and executed in Nevala and in Wicca and witchcraft. It's really something that you just figure out a variety of ways to access it for yourself or from other people. So it's not like, you know, you have to find a ley line and the nexus point, and then you can like do all of these things. You know, it's really like just this natural process. So the way you learn it is a very organic, environmental kind of learning. You learn it by the things around you, and you learn it by trial and error, what works for you, what doesn't. So it's a very organic process of learning. It's a very lifelong process of learning, and a very tangible process of learning as well. You know, you learn it from what the things are around you and the people around you.
Yeah, it's funny just thinking about it. And at least as far as how I've been approaching Ironbound with my own group and everything, this question actually came up in our last game because I introduced that some Nevalans were born with the ability to change into animals. And the question then kind of came up of just like, oh, so is that, you know, they're not really good at doing magic because they can turn into animals, and kind of figure that out. And the answer I ended up going with is that in our version of the game, Nevalan witches are people who are born to it. They have an aptitude. It's part of their heritage. They come from a family going backwards. We kind of set it up as being it's kind of in their blood, so to speak. And then there are others. It's not to say that others can't learn magic, but they have just a natural adeptness to it. Much in the way that some people are born with the gift, they see ley lines, whereas others have to train themselves and that kind of thing. But it really made me stop and think, as like, you know, we ourselves never really looked at how it is learned. And even too, if I think back on a lot of other RPGs that I've played with magic in them, learning has always just been very individualistic, in that you yourself as the individual character learn this one particular spell, and it has all the particulars on how and when you can execute it, rather than as a society how magic is actually learned and then executed and implemented and everything like that. It's I personally find it gets kind of glossed over a little bit as far as like how it works as an overall magical society. It's always very individualistic. How do you learn how to cast a spell? And then how do you actually cast it? And then, as I find with a lot of things actually in the fantasy genre, it kind of gets gleaned over a little bit. You just learn it. You just do. It's going to take you a little bit of time. Uh-huh. I remember some of the older games, like some of the original games back in the 70s and stuff, you could only learn a spell if you found it during your adventures. So if you wanted to learn a wish spell, you had to go find a copy of the wish spell. So then you could copy it into your book, rather than, I gained a new level, I get another spell. Well, let's just say I've been taking notes along the way, you know, and I'm just going to whip up a spell that just happens to be Fireball. Excellent. Perfect. You know, it had a bit more of a narrative hook to it, as I've learned, you know, is really the case with a lot of OSR stuff. But it's interesting when you stop to think about it, just like, yeah, how did magic actually kind of come about? Like, you know, I think it's also too, and I want to get your opinion on this. It's just like there's almost always an implication that books are involved, that basically in order to learn magic, you have to learn how to read, whether or not it's in the common tongue or it's in, you know, a mystical language or some kind of thing like that. Have you found that to be the same?
Yeah, in a lot of cases, they'll say, you know, writing it down in a book and stuff like that. In terms of real life and Nevala, since we're kind of basing, you know, I mean, yes, you learn from books. I mean, yes, but you also learn from people and in a practical, hands-on kind of way, and conversation and oral tradition kind of way too. So it's both, you know. I mean, it really is both. And if you don't read or whatever from books, you can still learn quite a bit of magic, you know. It's just certain ways that some people access magic, such as by writing stuff down, like what they desire, would not be something that you do. It would be more like you would pick something to represent whatever it is you're trying to convey in the magical working. You know what I mean? So it's not necessary, but it is an avenue that many, many people use in Nivala and in real life witchcraft and Wicca, you know. And but I agree with you in that, like, a lot of other places tend to do have it, like you learn from a book and you learn that way. But, you know, I mean, they also do, you know, I've had in games where you, like, you have a mentor and stuff like that, or you go to a school, you know, or something like that, and you learn.
Yeah, yeah. I think one of the other things you kind of hit on there is that with Nivala, magic is definitely way more free form, which is another thing I don't really recall seeing too often in a lot of games. In many cases, magic is executed very specifically, and that's because it has to work within the game mechanics. Whereas the idea of kind of free-forming spells and saying, okay, well, based on who my character is and other actions they've taken in the past, these are the kind of spells that you could expect to see my character cast. These are the particular ways that I do rituals and that kind of stuff. Whereas a lot of times you see things very locked in. Fireball is cast this way. It goes this far. If you put a little extra training and effort into it, you could maybe make it go further or boom louder, and, you know, and other kind of stuff like this. But it's, in many cases, it's a very set mechanical option. It does this and it does this at this time, so long as you roll that. And I know for me personally, I'm starting to like the more freeform stuff where you have the ability to build something or just create it completely narratively, and then the mechanics just kind of roll with it, so to speak. But yeah, that one's, I think one of the things with this first question, and I think with a lot of these questions, that there's two ways to look at them. There's how the individual approaches the magic system, but then there's also how the game's society approaches the magic system as well. And I think with this question, looking at it from a societal point of view of how everyone learns and executes magic rather than just the individual, I think you could really kind of go in some interesting directions with this that I think often get kind of glossed over.
Yeah, yeah, I think you really can. I mean, because in Nivala and in real life witchcraft and Wicca, your question is not, how do I, you know, how do I do this, right? In a way, I don't know if I'm going to phrase this right, but it's not like, how do I start to where I end up? You kind of work backwards. You sit and you think, what is the result I want, or I want to see? What am I trying to accomplish? What's the problem I'm trying to solve? Right. And you work backwards to try to achieve that, instead of starting with, I'm going to do a spell, you know, and so I have to do this, that, and the other thing to get here. You kind of start with the end result and then go backwards to see what you need to do that. And so we've set up the system so that really you can do that. You know, you can say, what are you trying to do? And then use the skills you have to see how well you can execute that result, you know, and intent matters. What you're trying to do matters, and why you're trying to do it matters. And that's going to determine it. And just like in real life, you know, we've kind of mentioned, you know, how is it access and stuff like that. As a person and as somebody who does magic, everybody has their own talents. That's no different. Everybody can do magic if you know they put their mind to it and they want to. the thing is everybody's going to be more talented at doing certain things than others. That's just the way it is. You know what I mean? Some things are going to click with somebody more than somebody else, you know? One common example in witchcraft and Wicca is divination. You know, there are tons and tons and tons of ways to do divination, a form of magic, trying to define the future or get guidance from the future. But, or trying to figure out a path which way you should go is how I mean, people know it as seeing the future, but it's not really that. But that's a whole nother episode in and of itself on what divination yeah. actually is. It's a whole nother topic. But it's always one of those things where if you start to get into divination, there are so many tools and you are going to click with and you are going to be a better hand at interpreting some than others. You know, you're going to have a natural affinity for ones than the others. And that's just people. That doesn't really have anything to do with magic specifically. It's like some people take to swimming naturally. You know, some people take to singing naturally. It's like your makeup and your body just naturally have an affinity for doing certain things. And certain types of magic are the same way. You know, there are certain people who are amazing at kitchen witchcraft, you know, cooking stuff up in the kitchen and giving it magical intent. I am not. So, you know, that's not my thing. You know, I use stones a lot in my stuff and I like that and I love doing that. And as far as divination, my affinity is for tarot cards, but I know people who do runes. I know people who do scrying, which has never been an easy thing for me to do, but some people can do it. You know, it's just like you find your own like things there. You have your strength and weaknesses, just like anything else. You know, magic is no different than that, you know, and they don't usually, going back to what you were talking about what they acknowledge in games, is they don't really acknowledge that. I think the best way you could do it is you have a domain and you might get a bonus to doing something within that magical domain or something like that. But if somebody does a fireball, they're going to be all be doing a fireball the same way, right? The fireball is going to have the same effect. It's going to go just as far. You don't have people who have a natural affinity for throwing fireballs, you know, like they, and they can just throw a longer fireball or they can throw a hotter fireball or whatever. But in novella and real witchcraft, you do, you know, you do have people who can do things. They just have a knack for it, you know, and that just happens, you know, whether their brain just clicks with it or whatever, you know?
Yeah. I would almost kind of say the first question is almost why? Like, why do you need magic? Why do you want to use magic? It's actually, upon reflection, it's a question I end up asking players a lot when it comes to the use of magic in Ironbound, is kind of like, okay, well, why are you doing this? Why do you want to, you know, set your arrow on fire when you launch it into the air, and to kind of think of like, you know, like what it is that you are trying to accomplish from something. And then from there, everything allows you to figure out, it's like, okay, so because I'm trying to help my friends, I'm going to choose the, you know, the aspect of helping my friends. That's going to add more dice to the pool and everything else like that. So I would almost kind of say, like, in, especially in the case of Ironbound, you know, and quite possibly in the case of witchcraft too, the why, like we talked about before, might almost be like the primary question rather than the how or the what, that you see so often in a lot of just magical fiction in general, to tell you the truth.
Right. Yeah. And as far as executed, how is it executed? The second part of that question, I mean, so many ways. Dancing, singing, speaking, poetry. I mean, in novella and in real witchcraft, magic can be executed a whole number of ways. You know, there are some traditions that are very much more rigid in doing things a certain way. There are some that aren't, you know. And I feel like novella is the same way. Like, some people have certain ways they have to do things. Some people are more like improv, you know, like, you know, but there's so many ways, you know, ritual bath, singing, dancing, chanting, being silent, you know, meditating, hand gestures, you know, anything you can think of, to kind of get tap into that energy you're trying to tap into. Because it's really all magic is, at least in terms of Nivala and witchcraft, there is energy in the world. There is energy out there that can be focused and used to do certain things. And what magic does is simply create a connection to that energy so that it can be moved, right? So that you can get it to do what you want it to do. That's all. So in terms of how to do that, like, any number of ways that work for you. And that's why it's kind of very individualistic. It's like, if somebody is going to do a task, nobody's going to do it the same way, but they can all accomplish the same result. You know what I mean? If I'm going to write a book, let's say, and you probably understand this, and a lot of people, if you're going to write something, you sit down and there's a lot of different ways to do it. At the end, you and I are both going to have, let's say, a 2,000 word piece that we're writing for an RPG. We both get hired to do that, right? Let's just say we're on a project. We get hired to 2,000 words, a short thing on how to, you know, on writing something, right? At the end, we are both going to have 2,000 words to turn in, right? We're going to have the same product, right? However, how we get there is going to be vastly different, right? It's going to be vastly different. You write things way differently than I do. You know, some people are planners. Some people are just like, you know what? I'm just going to spit everything out and then work with it later. Some people are like, I need music to do this. Some people are like, I don't. Some people are like, I need to put it back on the burner for a day or two before I get started thinking about it and percolating. So many ways to go about it, even though at the end, we both have 2,000 words.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. And even those 2,000 words are not going to end up the same, right? Even if we're writing about the same subject. So even the result is going to be a little bit different, even though the end result is 2,000 words on the history of this place, right? We're both hired to write 200 words on this history. It's going to be different from both of us, but still at the end, yeah, 2,000 words on history, but I'm going to bring it across differently than you do. And my process to get there is different than yours. It's the same with magic. You know, if we want to accomplish the same thing with magic, like, let's say, you know, set an arrow on fire, you know, our process for that is going to be different. Like, you know, to use your example from earlier, it's going to be different. You know, I might be the type of person, if I'm going to set an arrow on fire using my magic in this system, you know, what I have to do is I have to, like, you know, hold it aloft and chant some things, and then it turns to fire in my hand, right? You know, whereas you might want to do the same thing, you know, but instead you shoot the arrow, you make some hand gestures, and it turns into flame and hits its target, right? Same thing, we have an arrow on fire hitting a target, but we both accomplished it in different ways, right? And even the fire might look different. Maybe the tip of my arrow is the only thing on fire. Maybe it's a blue, you know, it's like a blue fire just at the tip, whereas yours is like literally an arrow made out of fire, you know? But at the end, at the base, it's the same thing, but it's executed and looks different depending on who's going to be doing it.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It's got me thinking too that there's, I'm reading the First Law trilogy from Joe Abercrombie at the moment, and there is light bits of magic in it, but when it happens, it's incredibly powerful and very unexplained, in the sense that it is beyond the understanding of most mortal people, that when it happens, your senses kind of just, you know, like, you're just not able to figure out, well, how did he cast it? He didn't flick anything. He didn't say anything. He didn't even so much as blink. And now all of a sudden this person has just exploded all over the wall, you know, like, and that I find also really kind of an interesting too, the idea that it is something beyond average understanding, that you don't even recognize someone's getting ready to cast magic. They just suddenly do it. Yeah, and that's just, you know, like, a more narrative ways of being able to introduce that kind of strangeness into the fantasy world. But that also feels like it's starting to lean on one of the future questions. So is there anything more we wanted to add on to this first one before we move on to question two?
No, I think I'm good. I think that was a really good, well-rounded, like, talk about how we feel about that. I think we're good. I think
yeah.
I think we got the point across.
Yeah, yeah. And it's good that this question is first, because the order of these questions can really make a big difference too. But I mean, like this one, mm-hmm. just the fact of how much time we spent it on already just goes to show how important that first question is on so many different levels. So yeah, question two, how is it accessed? And I think what they're going for with this question is, where does magic come from? And then how do you tap into it or steal it?
Right.
Kind of thing like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. In our case, I mean, there's lots of things, you know, that I've seen in different fantasy stuff, you know, magical items, right? You know, you have a magic staff and you learn how to use that, right? Items themselves are magic, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Or, you know, you access it by going through some sort of trial that unlocks your magic or whatever, right? You access it different ways or, you know, whatever. You get tattoos and those tattoos allow you to do different things. But in terms of Nivala and witchcraft and Wicca in general, it's more like it's always there. Like as soon as you're born, because you're connected to everything, including the energies that are used for magic in Nivala, you know, everyone is born with the ability to access the magic. They are. And it's not a matter of like unlocking it in the sense that we might think, like one ritual, you know, and then all of a sudden, you know, you have power at your fingertips. It's more like over time, as you grow up, you learn over time solely how to make the connection to the energy used for magic and use it. And you get more proficient over time and everything like that. And you learn its nature. And so it's more like the how you access it is by learning how to connect with the energy, the natural energy that is magic in the world of Nivala. The energy of the universe, the energy of the world. That's how you access it. You learn how to make that connection to that energy so that you can then direct it where you would like it to go.
Yeah. Yeah. It's very much magic in Nivala is part of the natural world. And it's simply a matter of knowing where to go to be able to tap into it and to be able to access it. Much like sap in a tree. If you just look at a tree, you don't think that it's got this yummy gooey liquid in there that is delicious on pancakes. It's not until someone teaches you, you know, that there is sap under the tree and here's how to take the sap out. And then here's how to harness it and to turn it into a syrup. That's how magic very much works in the sense of Nivala, in a sense where it's just like it is there as part of the world itself. Unlike, you know, in some other forms of fantasy, where if it isn't natural, in the, you know, like running parallel with the natural world and it's part of nature, I find a lot of times it is either locked away in a far off dimension, and that magic spells and rituals allow you to access that other dimension and kind of steal the magic from it. Or it's divine in the sense that this is about mortals who are able to access the power of the gods. This is something that only the gods were able to do. And, you know, like how you hear in a lot of mythology how the gods, you know, taught people how to make fire. The gods also taught people how to use magic, kind of thing like that. Those seem to be the most common three that I've come across in a lot of fantasy in general. Is it's either scientific in nature or arcane, maybe another way of putting it, where there's some kind of scientific basis, or it's a natural element where it runs parallel with the physical world, or it's divine in the sense of that it comes from, you know, the gods, the afterlife, you know, and that kind of thing. Or, and sometimes too, they can be a little bit of mixes in between, but for the most part, I always find that they tend to be from one of those three, almost kind of like those are the three sources of magic, so to speak.
Yeah. 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 I mean, that makes sense. Yeah. I mean, so, I mean, really, it's accessed through, you know, being able to have that connection, however you need to have that connection. You know what I mean? However you need to tap into that mindset that gets you to do that, you know, that gets you to that place where you can start manipulating energy.
I think it's also important too to consider, you know, the morality of taking that magic. So going back to the First Law trilogy, magic is okay. It's not, as I understand it, not really meant for the average person to use, but it's okay for some people with a lot of training and discipline to use it. But there are certain things you do not do. And if I remember correctly, the first law is you cannot communicate with demons. And because it turns out the demons are the ones that actually taught people how to use magic. And then the second law, and I may be getting these mixed up, but the second law is then that you cannot eat the flesh of people, because you can actually use that to make yourself powerful. But, you know, then you become corrupt by demons and everything else like this. And in that sense, their form of magic is much more forbidden, stolen, but then the cat got out of the box and now it's too late to go back and undo everything. So now at the very least, we're going to try and control it and limit it since it's out there. But it's a forbidden practice, whereas in others, it's wide open, it's accessible. There could even be some settings where, like Earthdawn, that one magic is so prevalent in the world and runs parallel to it. It's a natural thing that it's expected that a lot of the characters have some form of magic in them. Even if they're just swinging clubs and just trying to bash skulls, they're actually using some form of magic in some way to aid them in their actions at almost all times. So I think that's also a really kind of interesting way of, when you look at how it is accessed, it's also too, it's kind of like, is it accessed in a way that is permitted, or is it accessed in a way that is forbidden? Is it being stolen? Is it being borrowed? Or is it simply being claimed, where you get to have it, you use it, and that's it, no consequences? Whereas if you borrow it, you'll see that in some games where there's some kind of a cost involved. The more magic you use or the more powerful it gets, the more things start to backfire and start to change you physically or morally. A lot of older games had ones where certain spells could actually slowly change your alignment. So the more evil spells, quote unquote, that you use, the more your character would start shifting towards evil and those kind of things like that.
Oh yeah, Aberrant had something similar. The White Wolf Aberrant superhero game, they had taint. So if you had power and you kept using it and your abilities, you would become less and less human over time. The more power you had.
Yeah. It's like as a way to kind of keep it in check. Especially too when there's a very powerful system where someone who has access to magic can do an awful lot of damage within the setting. So that's how it's controlled and limited and everything. Yeah. And that's one of the things. It starts to open it. When you know how something is accessed, it could then have some really interesting changes on what you can then do with it and the limits that it might have, which is another question that comes up. Like in Ironbound, one of the main things that we have is that while you can use it to protect yourself and your fellow community members and your other coven mates and everything else like this, the idea is that magic is not to be used offensively or violently. And so that's why there are certain things that will happen to certain characters if they, and that's why a lot of my players are always trying to make sure that they're not initiating the violence, they're just reacting to it and responding accordingly, because otherwise they start to take penalties. It starts to affect their mental health after a while and everything like that, because it goes against how they were raised. So there's a lot of interesting little tweaks you could even take to like a magic system that already exists, change how it's accessed, and all of a sudden you can go in a completely different direction.
Right, yeah. For real.
So we got question number three. Does it have a will of its own? And I love this idea of magic mm-hmm. actually being a sentient thing that you can almost interact with in some way, shape, or form. I just love mm-hmm. that concept.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of like witchcraft and Wicca and even Novala, it's more like it's not like a will of its own, but it has a natural state of being and a natural tendency to do certain things, like anything in nature, right? Like water, you know, flows down with gravity. You know what I mean? Like leaves fall off in the winter, you know, it's just things naturally have a tendency to do that. And you can manipulate it, but if you leave it alone, it'll do what it's naturally supposed to do. And I always feel like magic is the same way. You know, that energy that you're using will naturally go to a place unless you, you know, start changing it and moving it and manipulating it, right? Just like I said, just like water flows downhill, you know, or, you know, grass blows in the wind or, you know, whatever, you know, water freezes at a certain time, you know, things have a natural tendency to do things. So unless you do something about it, it's going to do those things. Like, hey, water freezes at a certain temperature. But if it's that certain temperature outside and water would freeze, but you're like boiling it under a fire so it doesn't freeze, you're then manipulating that energy. But if left alone without your intervention, it would freeze.
Yeah. 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 If we look at that as being like, you know, that is magic's choice is to follow the rules of physics and nature and everything else like this, rather than to always rebel against it. I would say too, when it comes to Ironbound, I would almost say that there is an argument that it does have a will of its own, because if you use magic within your coven to aid somebody on the team, to help them out, you roll burst dice. Like anything you roll that's a six, you get to roll another die to go with it. So in that sense, that's almost as like magic, Naval and magic is saying is like, ooh, I like what you're doing and I'm going to help. I want to encourage this kind of behavior. So I almost say that,
yeah,
Ironbound magic has a little bit of that, but it's not so much of like a, oh, well, this is my will. It has to be this way. Kind of like what you see with a lot of clerics and priestly characters in a lot of games. Their form of magic, it has a morality compass that comes with it. There's a morality clause. It's like, you can use it, but don't do anything evil. Or you can use it, but no bringing back the dead. Yeah. Okay. Bringing back the dead is bad. Remember, we learned about this in seminary school. So it can be restrictive, but at the same time, too, it could also be encouraging and rewarding for the things that just like, yes, you are, you know, a disciple of this form of magic. And so because you are setting a good example and demonstrating what it is that we are about, here's a little extra. Here's a +2 bonus. Here's 2 extra dice to add to your pool, et cetera, et cetera.
Right, right. And I actually tend to think of it as not necessarily, and this is probably where we differ. I mean, it's just a slight philosophical difference, but I tend to think of it as it's not necessarily that it like approves of what you're doing, but you are shoveling the magic into a place where it can naturally go. So it's going to go, right? It's going to go a lot easier rather than if you're trying to do something that would go against what the magic would naturally do, which is going to be harder. Right. The more you're trying to resist something that it naturally wants to do, the harder it's going to be. Right. You know, the more opposite it is. And so to do the best magic, you need to kind of do things to aid to make the magic where, you know, feel like it's going to go where it's going to go naturally. You know what I mean? Like do it in a way where it would kind of flow into that result naturally because you're helping it. Right. Like if I want to fill, like use my water example. If I want to fill a bowl of water, you know, there's lots of ways I can do it. But if I'm going to do it a way that water just doesn't go, then that's going to be a lot harder. Right. I have a bowl and I'm trying to hold it, you know, above the faucet to fill it. you know, in order to do that, if I have the faucet here on the sink and the bowl is up here, I can do it, but it's going to require me like putting a hose on the faucet and like finagling it so it goes above the bowl. And then I'm going to need a lot more water pressure to fight gravity to put it in the bowl. You know, like I'm having to do all these things to get the water in the bowl when I could just put the bowl under the faucet and let the water do what it naturally does to fill the bowl. You know what I'm saying? Does that make sense?
Yeah. It does. Yeah. No, that's an interesting way of looking at that. And I'm definitely going to start, try and implement that a little bit more as we kind of go further. Just like, you know, hey, don't fight it. Just roll with it.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, and that doesn't mean it can't be manipulated or whatever. It just means that the more you try to manipulate it in a way it doesn't want to go, the harder it's going to be. And the harder of a rigmarole you have to do. And the consequences could be dire. Because magic, just like anything else in Nivala and the world, is an ecosystem. It's part of the ecosystem of the world. So if you do too much to upset that ecosystem, Valak, if you're trying to manipulate it too much, there are going to be consequences. Yeah. There's going to be consequences of that because it's not doing its natural thing in the ecosystem, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. It's also too, it was something we wanted it to be a positive force in the world, that somebody was trying to take for nefarious means. And so as a result, we only wanted it to encourage rather than discourage. So that's why, like, there's nothing in the game at this point that is, if you try and use magic this way, you'll take a penalty to it. There's never anything like that. The only mechanical options we have with magic are ways that it can help you out in times of trouble, and that kind of flexibility and everything. It's only existing in a positive space. There's never any, you know, no-nos. There's never a point that Nivala's magic is going to basically wave a finger at you and cut you off, you know, until the next full moon. It's always there as a sign of positive reinforcement. And if you kind of do something kind of a little bit kind of against your values or something like that, you're not going to get punished for it by magic, at least. If anything's going to happen, it's going to be internally within the character.
Right. And you know, I mean, it doesn't necessarily work that way in real life, I'll acknowledge, because magic is a natural thing, therefore it's neutral, right? It's natural. It isn't good or bad, right? It's just a natural thing. You know what I mean? It doesn't exist in a morality space, right? The morality exists within the person using it, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, and that may be something we want to look at eventually, like with the game. I mean, and if we want to choose to do, I mean, this is like gets into game discussion, which nobody was expecting, but you know, if we want to do the positive, that's cool, right? That's how it works. But you know, making that conscious decision rather than and realizing that doesn't necessarily always work that way. Because, you know, like I said, Wiccans and witches and you know, magic is neutral. Like the only kind of morality there is the one that the person is putting on it or the ones that humans put on it. Nature itself doesn't have morality. You know what I mean? It doesn't recoil at an animal eating another animal. It doesn't recoil at earthquakes and tornadoes and any other thing that we think is bad, you know, because they're not. They're just things that happen in the world. And there isn't really anything you can truly do about it except protect yourself from it. And we always kind of view magic the same way, you know, that it's there and it's a force of nature and it's a product of nature and it doesn't have morality. It's what you do with it, you know, and how that person views that morality, you know, there are witches out there who do things that I would never do, but they have a different set of priorities and morals than I do. And so they do those things. But the thing is, the judgment is on my end, right? The judgment is on my end, or maybe even the majority of society's end, right? We don't not kill people because, you know, the nature cares that we kill people. We don't kill people because we as people have decided that's a morally wrong thing to do, you know?
Yeah.
And even then there's wiggle room, you know, if you're defending yourself or something like that, you know, people are going to be like, well, you know, like, but that's something that we put on it. If a human murders another human, it doesn't matter to nature. You know, it doesn't. It just doesn't. And we always kind of feel like I always view magic as the same way. The morality and judgment that you're putting on it is the one that you're putting on it as a person, as a human who lives in a society that has morals.
Yeah. 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 No, that's very true. I think another way of looking at this question, too, is whether or not the magic has sentience. Because... and in thinking about it, and I've put a little bit of this in the Ironbound as well, back when I was doing the play by post, and you were able to read as well, so you had access. You were our audience, basically. We were performing our game for you. And there was a point where someone cast, they went to cast a very powerful ritual. I don't remember specifically what it was, but what happened was that it actually ripped the giant machine apart and exposed the corrupted magical energy inside. And because it had happened so early in the encounter, I didn't want to just end it and say like, oh, wow, you just completely obliterated the machine. Problem solved. I had the magic, basically this corrupted magic, because it had been harvested and converted into something that was never really meant to be. So it unleashed in kind of like a wild tempest of magic, what I ended up calling a wild storm. And right. what happened was then those Ironbound, they used magic to basically reach out to it telekinetically, and they could feel that it was in pain and it wanted to be free. It didn't like being contained and corrupted and mutilated and everything in itself. And in that sense, those players realized that magic was actually a sentient thing that did have a will of its own, in the sense of like, let everyone be free, including me, us, you know, however you want to use the pronouns on something like that. So in that sense, it's also a question too, is like, you know, is magic sentient? Even if it doesn't have judgment, even if it is completely neutral and it exists, but... you know, like, that's an interesting way to potentially look at magic too. It also makes me think of games out there like Third Eye Games' Sins of the Father, and I think there's a few other ones out there too, where, well, even in two, the two that we were talking to, Witch, Faded Souls, magic comes from a source who is like a sentient individual. And in that sense, you could look at it as being, it is their will that determines how the magic is supposed to be used. So there are ways where magic has been applied as having morality to it in some way, shape, or form. But I think that those are, once again, if you kind of stretch this question out a little more than what's actually written down, you could look at this as being like, is your magic sentient? Is it aware of itself and its place in existence and its position within this hierarchy amongst mortals and everything else like that? Just to go a little deeper with it.
Right. I mean, that makes sense, you know. And the thing is, people are gonna take that. I mean, you know, the wild storm could also just be, and it, you know, if you're talking about like going back to the first things you were talking about, like it could also just be an effect of the magic not being able to go where it wants to go naturally in such a non-natural state that this happens. This is the consequence of disrupting the natural order, you know? Yeah. So, you know, it wants to be free. It wants to do what it wants to do naturally. You know, it wants to be in its natural state.
Yeah. We basically kind of put it through a bit of a psychosis. But then the idea was that once it realized that it was free you know, stopped being destructive, and they were able to actually calm it down, kind of basically kind of talk it off the ledge. And mm-hmm. in doing so, then it kind of dissipated and returned to the world, and you could see things start to regrow again and everything else like that.
Right.
So,
yeah. Makes sense.
Shall we go to question four then?
Four. Is it restricted in space and time?
Yeah. So when I first read this one would just kind of seem pretty self-explanatory, because from a game standpoint, everything's always limited in space and time. Magic can only go so far. It can only do so much for so long. I've often seen, you know, like whether or not it says, nope, it lasts instantaneously, which means as soon as it happens, bam, the effect is done. Or you'll have something where by default, nothing can last more than a year and a day. So even if you do a ritual, you're going to have to renew it after a year and a day in order to keep it going. So, you know, to me, this question seemed a little kind of self-explanatory in that sense. But since none of these other questions are all that self-explanatory, what is it when you look at this question, what are some things that come to your mind?
I think in my thought, the first thing that came to mind was it's asking, like, does it obey the laws of physics and nature? You know what I mean? Like, does it have, you know, physical boundaries, or is that only your imagination? You know, do you have phenomenal cosmic power like the genie? Yeah. You know, or is it more like, you know, you can only do certain things? You know, like it only works a certain way, you know? Yeah. So, and that leads into a weird philosophical question, I will say. That leads into a weird philosophical question of, do we know the limits of time and space? Like, something that may seem to us to be beyond the limits of time and space or impossible could easily be a natural thing that we just have not comprehended or found out about, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you have to ask yourself, is it a limit in space and time to us? Or is it completely beyond the boundaries of time and space and natural order and whatever, is a completely separate thing that we just, you know, that we just tap into? Or is it a natural thing that we just don't know is a natural thing yet, because we can only comprehend, because we have limits as humans, you know what I mean? So we view things differently, and we have different finite limitations, you know? And is it just something that we don't know is our limitation and not space and time?
Yeah. It's making me think of the Ant-Man films, because I'm really psyched to see the third one. I'm really super psyched to go see it. But in that
Quantumania.
Oh, yeah, that looks so good. But in that one, time travel is possible by shrinking down super, super small into the quantum realm, where physics doesn't quite work the same. And then it's actually possible to time travel by changing your own physical dimension, you know? And to me, that's definitely one of those things where you can only explain it for so long. After a while, we're just going to have to buy it. But it's based on what I understand to be sound theoretical physics. But it's just one of those things where, like you said, it's operating at a level that we as a general population do not understand. It's just like, wait, so you can get smaller and go back in time? And even too, if you listen to some people who are actually studying the possibility of time travel, the idea is that it might not be possible to travel in time, but it might be possible to send messages through time, so long, you know, like by using a beam of light, and anything that is projected in through that beam of light, so long as that beam of light is running. So if it runs for 50 years, there could be messages within the light at any point in time in that 50-year period, kind of thing like that. Really, really, really deep metaphysical stuff that, is just beyond us. So is that the way that magic kind of bridges that gap? You know, and this once again can go back into that line of the question of how it is accessed. Are we supposed to know that this can happen? Are we supposed to know that if you travel to the quantum realm, you could actually travel, you know, forward and backward in time? Or did we break something and there's consequences to this? You know, like, yes. Are and we just ever... attracting attention, you know, from somebody way more powerful who's going to come and kick our butts, maybe?
Right. And as ever, we must refer to Jurassic Park and Jeff Goldblum as Dr. Ian Malcolm going, you were so preoccupied with whether or not you could, you didn't stop to think about whether or not you should, you know, and talking about, you know, the dinosaurs had their chance, you know, and they were extinct and that was what happened. And now we come along and we try to do this, you know, I mean, it's one of those things that you have to ask yourself. Yeah, I can do this. Should I do it? That's the big question, right? Yeah, I could do this with magic, but should I? If I do, what's going to happen? You know?
Yeah.
You know, so restricted in space and time, that's a big question. That's a big question. Ooh. In my opinion, it's not as pat as saying, yep, it affects everything that has a physical body and that's it. You know?
Yeah.
Or, you know, magic only affects your mind, or magic only does this, that, or the other thing. The magic in Avala is not like that. It's a natural part of the world. Therefore, if something is natural, magic can affect it. But the thing is, then you ask yourself the question, and you will have to make calls as the GM when you're running it. Is this natural or is it unnatural? Right? I mean, and what makes something natural or unnatural? You know, like, you know, I mean, if we make something, it's man-made, but it's made out of natural materials. I, you know, what are we talking about when we say time and space and nature? You know,
yeah.
What are the definitions of that? And I think that's something that's just going to have to be part of what the GM and their group put the spin on it as, because that's not something that I feel comfortable answering for anybody. You know, I mean, just, I mean, we can point it out and say, this is what it is, but you're going to have to decide what that means for you, you know, because that's what every witch has to do anyway. You know, you have to decide, now that I can connect with this and I know I can do things with it, what do I do? You know, and what are the limits of that? You know, and where are my limits? Where are my boundaries that I will not cross? You know? What is that? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's one of the things where, oh God, you know, we've seen that trope in a lot of things, right? Where, hey, there's this thing that has all of this power and stuff like that. And you don't want it to fall in the wrong hands. And why is that? Because it's not the item having all this power that's bad. You know, it's whoever gets a hold of it to wield that power that we determine is bad, quote unquote. You know what I mean? And not necessarily that item is, you know, it's the whole concept of, you know, make him king because he doesn't want to be king, you know, make them the ruler, be leader because they don't want to be the leader, you know, like, because people who don't want that power, the thinking is that they will have more respect for you and use it judiciously. Any kind of power, whether authority over other people, magic, whatever it happens to be. You know, and I think kind of magic works the same way in terms of limits. You know what I mean? Like, we're not quite sure. Like, if we take magic as a natural part of the universe, we really don't know what those limits are, but we can know what our limits are. And we know what our moral limits are and what our boundaries are. So I guess, is it limited in time and space? I guess the too long didn't read answer would be, it's limited by what the human wielding it can and is willing to do.
Yeah.
I guess.
Yeah. Because it could be a skill-based thing. In general, this particular spell is an instantaneous effect. As soon as it happens, boom, it is done. And, you know, if you create a light spell, the light spell will last for 1 hour. Boom, done. But if you are incredibly skilled at creating light with magic, you might be able to have it last 2 hours. You might be able to have it last a month. And, you know, so, I mean, some of it could be skill-based. I really like the idea, and I could see this in something, who is it, the magical detective, Harry Dresden. The idea, I've only read, like, the first book and some of the second book, but the idea of being, like, this magical detective to see if someone is, like, illegally casting spells, the idea of being able to pick up on the residue of magic, being able to find it, discover it, and interpret it. It's just like, ooh, someone cast a really powerful spell here, you know, and then discern the energies to determine. So in that sense, something that might be instantaneous, like a magic missile spell or something, extends out and it lasts longer than that instantaneous moment because it leaves this residual effect. And then if that's the case, what does this residual effect do after a time? Can it be used against somebody? You know, can you then pick it up and say, like, ooh, someone cast a magic missile spell. I want to take some of that energy so I can learn how to cast that spell myself. So there's a bunch of different ways that this can go.
Right.
And yeah, it could also go into like this, you know, super cosmic aspect of things of just like, what is space and what is time? Really? You know, there's a bunch of ways to go with this.
Yeah, yeah. And it's one of those things where there are so many factors that go into magic, like in how witches and Wiccans practice it. And we're trying to gamify that in Ironbound. So that's, I mean, a process, you know, because one, there's natural aptitude or affinity for doing certain things. So you've got that. You've got the ability to connect, you know, person has a natural affinity for something and stuff like that. That's a factor. How well they can connect to certain things, to magic and energy and stuff, that's a factor. Their moral compass, that's a factor. How much they're trying to go against what the natural ecosystemic purpose of magic is. You know, all of these factors come into play with how the result of a spell or ritual comes out and how well it turns out or not well it turns out. And you try to gamify that, that becomes a little more difficult because all those factors play a role. Morals, boundaries, physics, aptitude, everything, intent, all come into play. And you're trying to kind of gamify that in a way. So it's hard.
Yeah, for sure.
You're trying to gamify the limits, I think is what I wanted to say. Like, we're trying to gamify the limits. And when in reality, it's not that simple, but we're trying to gamify those limits, but there's so many factors that go into that, that it becomes difficult, you know? So we have to pick some things or not some things or another, unless we want to sit here and gamify five or six different things to see if a spell works out. Right. You know, okay, let's figure out your intent score. Let's figure out your, how much you're going against morals. Let's figure out how much you're, you know, like, and that's just a headache of a task. And I think that's an impossible task. So while in reality, there's all these different factors that come into play and is more complicated, just in real life, when you try to put it in a game, you know, you have to simplify.
Yeah. Yeah, you don't want a level one character who can teleport to the opposite end of the universe unless, you know, that's part of the level progression where it's like, oh yeah, level one, you're the equivalent of like a level 20 in other games. But then that means that the level 20 in this game means that, you know, you're fighting giant monsters made out of meteors who are throwing planets at you, you know, and can do 1 million plus 376 d20 damage, you know, and stuff like this. So if it's proportionate, but yeah, like there are almost always needs to be caps in some way, shape, or form, because otherwise, yeah, things can get ridiculously out of hand. Ridiculously out of hand.
Right, exactly. But with that being said, I think we got through four questions.
We did. Yeah, we did. So this might be a three-parter by this time. But that's the point with these. I mean, like, these questions are really, you can gloss over them. But, you know, when we were looking at them and just the idea and the potential, and then especially, too, once you know what all 12 questions are and are laid them all out, Like if this was a production meeting to figure out a new magic system, I think we've already burned through like several pages of notes each. So
yeah,
we'll pick this up next time and we'll continue. Maybe we'll finish. We'll get to 12. You know, and if not, then we need to take a little longer with this. But yeah, this is it's a really interesting, thought-provoking way to take a look at magic, especially too when there is so many examples of magic out there and you're trying to find a way to make yours different. That sometimes getting really deep into these otherwise simple sounding questions can allow you to find that little hook that makes yours stands out and then suddenly changes everything on so many different levels.
Right. Exactly. Yeah, I mean, if we do another four, it'll definitely be a three-parter. You know, we'll do another four, but who knows? Maybe we'll go quicker through the other questions. I don't know.
Yeah, the next question would just be like, no, I don't like that one. No, let's move on. Next question. Skip that one. Yeah.
Well, looking at them, I kind of doubt it. They all seem like interesting questions. So if I were going to lay money, I bet we have a three-parter. If I were forced to make a bet.
All right, done. We will plan on making this podcasting's ever first three-part topic. Boom, boom, boom.
Boom, boom, boom. Alrighty then. Well, I hope you enjoyed it. Please let us know, listening, what you think. What are the answers for questions your own game, if you have one, or what you're feeling, or any commentary that you have? We'd love to hear it. And until then, wish you a little magic in your gaming. And a little gaming in your magic. Until next time.
The Covenstead Podcast was created and produced by Danielle Delisle and Todd Crapper. Theme music written and composed by John Thompson from the Rook and Rask channel on Twitch. Definitely check them out. Special thanks to all of our backers. Alex, Tim Brannan, Chris Atrata, Century Guild, Nicholas Diak, Fool's Moon Entertainment, Kaboom.com, -50s, no apologies. Brian P. Kurtz, Jason LeDuc, Civ Light, Revna, Derek Simsek, Danielle Thomas, Phil Watson, Jacob Wood, and Victor Wyatt.
Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.